From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 5 for Friday, December 3rd, 2010. On the show today, we're going to be talking about how you can own your own street-legal Tron bike. We're going to talk about how you can name your own mathematical theorem if you've got the money, and we're going to debate the future of 3D cinema. Hi, I'm Nate Langson, and I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk, and coalescing around the Wired soundboard today is senior staff writer Duncan Gear.
Hello.
News editor Olivia Solon.
Hello.
And today, a special guest, Wired Magazine's test editor, Chris Finnemore.
Hi.
How are we all?
Good, thank you.
Pretty well.
Good.
Right.
It's been all of 2 minutes since I spoke to you. Cool. So, first today, there's this weird story we had about a Spanish woman who has tried to legally own the sun. Liv. No, Duncan. Tell me why.
Well, Liv can tell you if she wants, but...
I could do, but I didn't prepare this one.
Back in 1967, when space exploration was, you know, at its very peak, the UN published an Outer Space Treaty, which is ratified by 98 of the world's states, that said that space is owned by all of mankind, not alien kind, just mankind, and one nation can't claim sovereignty on any moon, any star, any other celestial body. But that specified governments. So governments weren't allowed to claim ownership.
And she's not a government.
She is a private individual. So in 1979, a new treaty was brought forward called the International Moon Treaty that said that private ownership of extraterrestrial locations was forbidden. But because the space race wasn't anywhere near its peak then, there was far less interest in it. Far fewer states ratified it, and Spain was among the states that hasn't ratified it. So, by law, she reckons she owns the sun.
So does this mean that every time Liv uses a solar-powered device, she's actually stealing from a Spanish woman?
Well, possibly. I'd wait till the lawsuit is resolved before we can decide that one.
But isn't she trying to charge accordingly?
Yeah, I think she sort of tongue-in-cheek said she's going to tax everybody who uses the sun. She said she's actually split it up between different parts of, you know, where she's going to give the money to. She's going to give 50% to the Spanish government for some reason, 20% to the Spain's pension fund. I would have thought that would be included in the government, but specifically the pension fund. 10% to research, in inverted commas. Don't know quite what that means. And 10% to ending world hunger.
Good.
Half as much as she's giving to the Spanish pension fund. And finally, she's keeping 10% for herself.
That's nice. That's very nice.
Yeah.
She's going to have so much fun trying to enforce this.
Hungry people in the hot, you know, famine-ridden countries afford their taxes?
I think they're going to have to go into hiding and not use any sun. Chris, how long until we can own the moon and Mars? Actually, funnily enough, forget that question, there are now three times as many red dwarf stars, I think, in the universe than we previously thought. So there's now three times as many things for us to own.
That's exciting.
Yeah, well, I mean...
Does that mean the mod prices come down?
Is it really? Is it actually exciting?
Do you know how many stars that we thought there were beforehand?
Off the top of my head, I think it's about 100 billion stars in every galaxy and 100 billion galaxies in the known universe.
Roughly.
So and that's now, 100 billion times 100 billion times 3.
The universe is infinite.
I think we need Frank Drake, the SETI guy who came up with the Drake equation, to work out
how many
stars there are. I don't know.
But there's probably more than one for every person in the world.
There is. And now there is a matter...
Just dole them out. Claim them.
Which one
get
would you
five
have?
A day.
Yeah.
What's your favourite star?
My favourite star?
Yeah. I like the third one along in Ursa Minor.
Vega.
Vega.
Yeah.
What's the best about Vega?
It was In Contact, and I love that book.
I like Barnard's star.
Barnard's star. Yeah.
Actually, I like the North Star. Can I have the North Star?
No.
No.
What you can have, though, is a mathematical theorem named after you. Liv, I don't think you wrote this story on our site, but...
I did, yeah.
You did?
Yeah.
I thought Mark wrote this, our friend Mark Brown. No?
No.
Very well. Well, in that case, I'm definitely going to ask you to tell me about it. How do I pay to get a mathematical theorem named after me?
Yeah, well, similar to how you can buy a star, there's a company in Edinburgh called Theory Mine. That is offering you the chance to pay to put your name to a mathematical theorem. And what they've got is they've got this kind of very advanced computerized theorem prover that is constantly working to prove different mathematical theorems. And what you can do is you part with £15 of your hard-earned cash.
Mm-hmm.
You get allocate a name, provided it's not libelous or offensive to anyone.
That rules
and
me
then,
out, then.
And then they get going on getting you a theorem. What I find a bit odd is that you don't kind of... They only do that once you've paid for it. So, I mean, I always think you would never name a child unless you'd seen it. You want to know what they look like before you give it an appropriate name. So here you've got a situation where you can't even draw any inspiration from what the proof looks like.
This is a great present for a maths geek at Christmas.
It is. But
completely unenforceable, I imagine. These aren't going to get in any history books, are they? I can't have the Langston equation.
You're not going to be getting any kind of Pythagoras theorem.
Well, I think it probably depends on the equation. You might get lucky.
Shouldn't they have a kind of premium version where they can prove an actual use for that theorem as well? So you've got the theorem and the proof. And
yeah, I definitely like one named after me to have
an
a use.
An application of it, yeah. But it's £15, but what you get is a PDF with the certificate proving...
A PDF?
Yeah.
Wow, that's so expensive.
You don't really get an actual certificate. You get a PDF which you can download and then print.
And I'll make you a PDF for a tenner if you like.
And I bet it comes in an email that says, please consider the environment before you print this theorem certificate.
But then you get your email and then you get the opportunity to put said theorem with your name on it onto mugs, T-shirts, and other paraphernalia.
This really is the week of utterly bizarre business ventures.
It is.
In 1 month, I'm paying theorem subscription and sunlight tax.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's pretty weird.
But you know what? They'll probably make a shed load of money.
Probably. Not from me, they won't. Someone has made a Tron bike in an effort to make a load of money out of people. You can buy a street legal Tron bike for about 35 grand. Chris, tell me about this, because we've got a big Tron cover feature in this, our new Wired.
We have, and the light cycle is a very iconic part of Tron. Obviously, even though it's only really a program within a virtual world, these guys have actually made a kind of real-life version of it. So it's definitely not a replica. Because it's a real live animated thing of something that was originally bit. What they've done is they've taken a V-twin bike engine from Suzuki, 1000cc one, and they've custom made this Tron bike, and it's actually got two. They've used a kind of friction brake for the front wheel, so it maintains the classic look without any calipers hanging off it or anything like that. I've seen the videos of it online, and it moves in a straight line, and the guy tries to turn and he can't.
Have we got a video of this on our website?
I don't know.
Seems like something we should have.
Yeah.
We have a story about it and a photo. We should probably have a video too.
It looks terrible.
It's not particularly practical to pop down the shops in, though, is it?
Well, not really.
I mean, you're in an almost kind of horizontal riding position.
Sort the shops. I want to know if it streaks out a big trail of light behind it or not. Does it?
It doesn't actually do that.
Oh, no.
Which is really sad. So all the videos online, you've got a guy...
Not even smoke.
You've got a guy in a T-shirt and he just kind of gets up to about 5 miles an hour. You know, doesn't really get his feet up because he's a bit scared. And then he just kind of stops because he can't turn it.
This really is taking the Tron guy thing to the next level, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So this bike weighs...
Sell them?
It weighs 474 pounds. It's 100 inches long and 23 inches wide. And the rider sits 28 inches off the ground.
Lies
28 inches off the ground.
It's even flatter than a normal superbike.
Yeah, that's pretty bizarre.
But it's fun. I don't think anyone's actually going to ride them anywhere. I mean, they might cruise up and down the Vegas Strip. They might stick them in their living room.
Yeah, they totally are going to ride them somewhere. Some idiot's going to get one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Probably one of us.
And you
to go with
your first Tron. And, you know, basically, during the first crash, it's actually going to explode into a lot of little sort of triangle vectors.
Well, talking of explosions, Liv wrote an interesting story this week about a colour-changing patch that detects bomb blast shockwaves that has some medical implications. Liv, what's this all about?
Yeah, this is really interesting. It's not quite as amusing as any of the other stories we've been dealing with so far, but one of the big problems in war zones, one of the main injuries that that soldiers are experiencing is injuries from the shockwaves of bombs, of IEDs. And they might not have any external sign of any damage, but the force with which the shockwave kind of emanates from the point of explosion is so strong that it actually kind of rattles people's brains within their skulls, and can cause it can cause almost instantaneous death, but it could also have, you know, subtle but very damaging kind of brain trauma as a result. So the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine and School of Engineering, Engineering and Applied Sciences, have developed a colour-changing patch, and it's kind of using the same iridescent nanostructure that butterfly wings have. It's actually the way it looks like. It apparently looks like Swiss cheese with columns in between, obviously on a very tiny, tiny, tiny scale.
And the idea is that basically this patch is worn by a soldier,
yes.
So you can visibly see how much basically the shockwaves that they've been around.
Precisely.
How
so
blasted they've
there'll
been.
There'll be no way
That was basically what I was trying to think of a way of saying, yeah.
Yeah.
How much blast they've been exposed to.
Exactly. And when these little nanostructures get damaged, they obviously change colour and they haven't quite developed it yet, but they can develop these structures so that they change a different colour according to how much of a force there has been. So it's a really easy way for people, medics in the field, to be able to instantly check how much damage someone might have had to their brain or internal organs as a result of a blast without having to, you know, peer inside and have a look.
And the idea there is that it makes it much faster to actually speed up medical attention.
Precisely.
That you might need.
Exactly that.
Well, on that note, we're going to move on to our feature this week, which is the future of 3D movies. 3D cinema has been in existence since the 1920s, but didn't see its first break into the mainstream until the 50s. Along with technologies such as smell-o-vision, 3D cinema has always failed to assert itself as an essential component of the movie-watching experience. But in the 21st century, mainstream adoption of high definition in the home has forced the movie industry to once again pick up the baton of dimensionalized film, and this time it's investing billions of pounds globally to make sure it sticks around. But are we ready for 3D? Is the technology finally worth part of Joe Bloggs' paycheck? And do we actually even want it? And I think the first question to answer here is how does 3D currently work since it's been around for so long? Chris, you're a bit of a film buff.
There are several different types of 3D, actually. In cinema context, originally they had you know, the coloured specs. But the way that it works now is you have actually a polarised screen.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is during alternate frames, so they'll project one frame, the left eye and one frame for the right eye, and they'll be slightly offset. The left eye frame will be polarised one way and the right eye frame will be polarised the other way. Your glasses are polarised accordingly. So that means that the wrong image will be blocked from the wrong eye.
I'm with you. So you're essentially getting one image per eye and it alternates,
yep,
between the two.
And it alternates between the two in the frames, which is why, for example, 3D TVs at home run at 120 hertz instead of 60.
Because it needs to show twice as many images.
Yeah.
So really, a 3D movie at home is basically just being shown on a very, very fast TV, and sort of the same thing in a cinema, only it's very, very fast projectors onto a screen.
Home ones are a little bit different in that home ones actually usually use active shutter glasses, which are the ones that it actually physically blocks the eye off for each frame, as opposed to having a polarising effect.
I mean, why is the movie industry promoting them so hard?
Piracy is one thing, surely.
Yeah, I mean, 3D movies are far harder to pirate than a traditional 2D one is going to be. I think that's definitely a factor. And also it's another gimmick to get people into cinemas. You know?
Even though it's, yeah. I mean, how much is a cinema ticket now for 3D?
About 12, 15 quid? 20 quid in places like the O2, I think.
It depends on where you go to, I think.
I think it's about creating more of an experience of film watching. That, I mean, cinemas have constantly, again, they're fighting against piracy, as you say, but it's about trying to create something that is so magical and unique about going to a cinema as opposed to downloading something and watching it on your TV, however big it is at home.
You sound like a fan. Are you a fan?
No, not. I've seen a lot of films that seem to have gratuitously added in a kind of 3D element, either in post-production or just didn't feel like there was a huge amount of benefit, at least of all for the amount you have to pay in extra to see it. I think Avatar, although, you know, perhaps I don't think it was the most amazing film from a plotline perspective, but from a visual perspective, it was incredible. I think that's the one film I've seen where 3D has really had a very kind of been really beneficial to the film. But then there's been a few kind of directors who are coming out not against 3D per se, but are, you know, not creating their movies in 3D, like Christopher Nolan with the Batman movie, which everyone was speculating about.
I was at Disney in London a few weeks ago, and again there they have a bunch of demos set up to show off how good 3D is, and they had Sky there and, you know, all the 3D TV manufacturers and stuff showing off the wares, and again it's just stuff flying at you in the demos and it really annoyed me. But I was there for like a satellite broadcast of a talk with James Cameron, and he was saying that it takes months and months and months of work to actually realistically make a two-dimensional movie 3D. And that seems to be that one of the trends at the moment is, you know, Titanic 3D and going back and re-releasing Star Wars for the 9,000th time just so it's in 3D. And it seems to be the first time where a lot of hardcore fans are actually kind of pissed off about it, because when Star Wars came out in high def and Blu-ray, you know, it's like it's the same film pretty much, but it's just better. Whereas this time they're sort of making it artificially different and not
You are changing the viewing experience, because then they're actually taking the film and they're deciding what bit is going to be 3D and what's going to happen and how much that, and you know, that could actually change your viewing experience of it.
Mm. I don't see it as any real difference between that and, you know, digitally remastering it and upping the resolution of some of the CGI and stuff like that, which they've done with Star Wars before.
Do you not think it's just kind of a giant gimmick just to
is digital remastering. It's just this one slightly more noticeable to the fan, you know?
Do you reckon? I mean, I think that it's quite different, that with a digital remaster, you are just remastering it. You're not necessarily changing anything. You're just making it clearer. Whereas with 3D, you're sort of taking an artistic standpoint and saying, well, I want this to be floating in front of the viewer's vision, you know, right in front of them, and this needs to be further away from them, in the same way that you can have something in focus or out of focus. Yeah. And
I was going to say, more importantly, you have to upgrade your whole kit in order to be able to watch a 3D movie, unlike the digitally remastered version.
Well, that's the thing. I think a lot of the consumer electronics companies are jumping very, very hard on 3D right now, and they have been for about a year. And they're you know, putting out all of this kit. You know, there's Panasonic, you know, 3D camcorders.
Yeah.
And I went to the launch of that, and they were saying, you know, oh, you can film your kids' first steps in 3D. And
I was,
does anyone
it.
Care? That's one of the other questions. Is does anyone except the manufacturing industry actually care? Because I am yet to meet anyone who says, I love 3D, this is the future of cinema. Everyone I've talked to, I mean, personally, as you can probably tell from my perspective, I really don't like 3D. I'm not supportive of it. Not because I don't like the idea of film being in 3D, but I want it to be shot in 3D from the beginning, where it's part of the story and not sold as kind of a stupid gimmick with CGI hamsters dancing at me or something like that. It's all it is.
But then you're a big fan of Jackass 3D, aren't you?
But this is the thing. The reason why I was really excited about Jackass 3D was because it's not something where you're basically just trying to throw stuff at the camera all the time and pass it off as story. Jackass 3D doesn't have a story. It's just a bunch of guys acting like idiots on screen.
Throwing themselves at the screen.
But you know what I mean? It's not. They're not trying to make the story different or something like that just because it's in 3D. They're not trying to make the audience jump necessarily. It's just kind of, here's a load of people on camera and they're being idiots. And this is one of the other things I wanted to talk about, is that the only thing that I've ever seen in 3D that I thought, okay, that's pretty decent, is something that I don't ever watch, which is football. And I think sport in 3D and stuff like documentaries, all that kind of stuff, wildlife stuff, things where, you know, it actually adds to the experience as opposed to artificially just tries to make you jump or make Duncan sneeze.
I quite like the make you jump thing element of it. I think that's the bit that makes it quite interesting. It's an effect that you can't get in a 2D screen, and I think it's...
But you've never jumped at a 2D film.
Oh, no, sorry. I mean, I have jumped, but when things are kind of being chucked at the camera and stuff like that, I think that's quite a nice little...
Always, you know, you go to Disneyland and you go into the 3D cinema, and then, you know, you'd have animations of people throwing beer bottles off roofs at you. And
or waving a sword in your face.
Yeah. And that's
the
when it's most evident, and that's when you can...
They're the ones you always see. I remember about 18 months ago, I was at a tech conference in somewhere else in Europe, and Philips had brought one of their 21x9 cinema screens that was 3D. I think it's out now, but at the time it was like a prototype. And again, the only demo that they had on there was of some dragon thing where it was just dragons flying at you and they would breathe fire. And
is that How to Train Your Dragon?
I don't know. I think at the time it was just some sort of a tech demo.
Oh, okay.
But again, the tech demo was just, look
dragon
at how amazing
T-Rex.
We make stuff flying towards you look. Mm. You know, which to me just isn't film. I mean,
it's a tech demo, but then that's what it was.
But it's always the same, isn't it?
It does work really well for games, is the only thing that I'd say.
So, I mean, you play 3D games. I've seen the NVIDIA glasses thing, you're a fan of it, obviously.
Those ones, I really liked it, and I had the NVIDIA system. I had an Asus laptop with the NVIDIA active shutter glasses. Works really well for games, especially ones that are, you know, 3D ready. And the one that I was playing was Just Cause 2, which is good fun anyway. But it really works in 3D.
It's full of these sort of big panoramic vistas as well.
Exactly. So you're standing on an edge and you look, you know, you can see the mountainside kind of shearing away, you know, and it really looks like it really draws you in a lot more. When you open your parachute, the parachute kind of comes out of the screen at you, and it really does draw you in. It works very well.
I've seen that,
I was going to quickly say, the game is something that you're used to buying quite a bit of kit for often anyway, and you're generally playing, well... A lot of games you play on your own, so it doesn't have, you don't come into the problems of being in a big group of a family watching
Well, that's one of the other main problems.
Pairs of 3D glasses.
That's it. I mean, that's one of the main problems with 3D is that the technology itself kind of inhibits it being adopted by everyone, simply because, you know, you need a 3D television, you need to pay, you know, £100 for each pair of glasses. So if you buy, so you get two in the box and you invite two friends round, one of two things can happen. They can either come round and say, oh, I can't watch this because I don't have any 3D glasses. Or maybe they'll say, it's okay, I'll bring my 3D glasses. I've got a 3D TV. And it's for a different manufacturer, so it doesn't work.
They
because they're two different
standards.
Exactly. And, you know, some of these things are ridiculous, where they work if you turn them upside down because they've just put the lenses in a different way. But that makes, you know, say a Samsung incompatible with a Sony.
But I mean, those are problems with 3D TV as it is today. But I think stuff like that is going to get solved within the next probably year, if not 2 years.
Well,
I mean, that's not a long term issue.
I think the glasses are just the big barrier, really. I think you can do it in the cinema. I don't mind watching Avatar in the cinema with a pair of stupid glasses on. But are you going to sit at home watching X Factor or the news with your glasses on?
Sky and Virgin Media are really heavily pushing their 3D packages, you know, this Christmas, because, you know, now 19 people have TVs that can support 3D in the UK, so it makes sense. But it is, like you say, you know, the cinema is kind of the way for now. But it seems that the next step for 3D is going to be auto stereoscopic screens, where these are televisions where you don't actually need glasses to watch them. And a lot of them exist in prototypes at the moment. They're very expensive to make, and so there's very limited appeal for a manufacturer to produce them.
How do they work?
Stereoscopic screens. So basically, it's kind of like a regular fast screen as we have now for 3D, but it sort of has I say like a film over the front of it, parallax barrier or something like that, I think.
Yeah.
And the idea is that basically it blends the two images at the same time, so you can watch it, but only from one position. It means you don't need glasses, but you basically have to look at it head on.
And only one person can.
And only, well, you can have it working with more than one person, but it means you have to split the resolution of the image in order to basically fire it the image in two directions. It's a very simplified way of putting it, but it means you make the screen send out two different angles of the two different images, so two people can watch it from two angles. But again, it means if you have five people sitting around, one of them on the, say, the left of the sofa, one on the right, the guy in the middle might not get the right image. So I mean, basically what it boils down to is that at the moment we find it inconvenient and expensive to have a 3D TV with 3D glasses to watch 3D Blu-rays on a 3D Blu-ray player. And then the next step for that is auto-stereoscopic screens, where you don't need the glasses, but you still have to be in either a certain position of the room. And so it's going to be the stage after that that it actually maybe answers some of our criticisms by making a screen where you don't need glasses and it doesn't really matter where you sit. That seems like many years away.
You should all have your own personal iPad screen just in front of you, and that'll be 3D, and then you can sit with everyone watching the same thing.
But if we do get to that point, and if it's in the next 6 or 7 years, are we actually excited enough by 3D now to even think, I'm looking forward to that, in the same way that we look forward to having widescreen TVs?
Because I wear glasses.
It would be interesting if you could have 3D prescription contact lenses.
Well, I do for the cinema, actually. I have a pair of clip-ons. I have 3D clip-ons.
I do.
And I look quite awesome.
I haven't been to the cinema in my glasses yet. That's definitely one to try.
I cannot tell you how much I want to see a picture of you. For anyone who hasn't seen Chris, he's got quite trendy big specs, and I can only imagine that with a clip-on on the front, 6'5".
You look like a sex pest.
I would look like a large, specky sex pest.
So I think we can conclude now today whether we actually like 3D with Wired or Tired. This is for 3D today. It's a bit, we talked about a lot, but let's just go with it. Duncan, 3D.
Tired.
Fine.
Tired.
Liv, tired.
Apart from for gaming.
Tired. I think we can conclude that we don't like 3D.
I don't know, even for gaming, I'd still say tired, and that's as a big gamer myself.
You think?
Yeah,
have
I mean,
not
it's
played
just
that game where someone waves a sword in your face and throws beer bottles at you. It's brilliant. It's got dragons in it.
I mean, it's all right and all, but it's just, it doesn't. I think games are interesting because, unlike films, there aren't any big kind of blockbuster games that have really been designed for play in 3D.
It did add some depth to Just Cause 2, which is a game without any depth.
But I mean, I had a really good time with Just Cause 2
anyway.
In 2D.
Yeah, true.
So I mean, it's kind of, I think maybe, you know, at one point there'll be some kind of game where the mechanic in the game involves using 3D, and it'll be fantastic, and then everyone will really get into it. But I think until that point, it's not really there. And for a game designer as well, who wants to get their content out to as many people as possible, it's kind of a bad choice, maybe, going for 3D, unless you've got a really good idea.
He did say tired.
Yeah, no one said Wired at any point. The Wired tide got swallowed
said,
by a talk
he
about
said,
video
except
games.
For games.
Yeah.
I did say
but
except
overall
for games.
Tired.
Overall tired.
I'm sorry, 3D. I'm really sorry. But you're just not good enough for us. We want to abandon you. But we're going to abandon that feature for now, and we're going to move on to our quick bites.
Barbie manufacturers are to sue artists who have created a nude calendar of the top-selling doll showing her in lesbian poses. Some months show the doll simply nude, while others use shots of Barbie posing intimately with another female doll. The Argentinian creators claim they have made the calendar with the cooperation of toy makers Matchbox, owned by Barbie's creators Mattel, and that it is a comment on how sex is used to sell everything in society.
Police in the US mistook a blood-splattered horror movie set for a real-life murder scene for 8 hours. One officer labelled the room the most grisly murder scene he'd witnessed in his 35 years in law enforcement. Police saw blood splattered everywhere, bottles of alcohol scattered about the room, and a piece of scalp with hair still attached. 8 hours into their investigation, police realised the blood wasn't real and that they were dealing with a set left over from New Terminal Hotel, a forthcoming horror film.
Fail.
Back in April 2008, a married couple named Aaron and Christine Boring sued Google for intentional and or grossly reckless invasion of their privacy because a Street View car drove down their private road and snapped some photos of their house. 2.5 years after the case has started, a judge has now ruled that Google was indeed guilty of count two trespassing. The Borings have won a grand total of $1 for their trouble.
And in cat news this week, although Duncan reckons this is actually squirrel news, but
it is
I don't care.
News.
It's got a cat in it. It's fine. It works as cat news. A cat in the US has taken in a baby squirrel as one of her own. Now the squirrel will let people pick it up and stroke it and even purrs like a kitten, according to the cat's adopted owner Jim Watkins, who told press, the squirrel will never be able to survive on his own from this point on because of the way he's been raised. We'll probably wind up keeping him.
Until he dies.
Yeah. Well, that's cat news.
That's
a bit cruel.
Is it cruel?
Oh.
Do you know what else?
Everything dies.
That was awful.
You know what? I've got a bit of bonus reindeer news. Apparently Hamleys on Oxford Street.
Penguins.
On Regent Street.
Penguin news.
They're getting penguin. It's penguin news.
They've cancelled the penguins.
They had reindeer in the store.
No,
just to sell.
Did they have it in the end?
Yeah.
I thought they had a huge uproar on social media saying that they're going to have reindeer and penguin in.
Well,
there.
they had reindeers,
penguins.
I think. And
well, reindeer, surely.
It is, but yeah. You know what I mean? So there you go.
What was the tweet storm about?
About the fact that they were bringing animals into a shop and it was going to cause them huge amounts of distress. But I figured they'd probably be show animals anyway that had been dragged around all sorts of children's parties.
Are they show penguins?
Exactly.
They don't just pick them out of London Zoo and take them out off for a tour in Hamleys. I think they're proper...
Them.
No, but they're penguins.
Trained penguins.
They've been abused before. They're used to it.
And on that note, I think it's time to end the podcast. Duncan, you have a friend who helped us out recently.
Yeah, his name's Philip Nisto, and he was the composer of the jingles that you've been hearing, the new jingles. We want to know what you think. You can tweet us at WiredUK. He did them very nicely for us under some direction, but...
By direction, do you mean you beat him down and sort of stapled him to the ground until he composes new money?
I just mean
theme,
I gave
for
him a,
free.
I gave him a load of words like inspiring and, you know, scientific and things like that.
A little mind map for him.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
And he came up with the fantastic jingles that you have been hearing and are going to hear as the podcast ends.
Wow.
So thank you to him.
I'm going to send him a Christmas present.
I worry about what it's going to be.
Yeah, so do I. I would be very worried. Well, anyway, on that note, thank you very much, Duncan, for joining
You're
us,
welcome.
As always, and for Liv joining us.
That's all right.
And Chris, probably
Thanks.
For the last time.
Probably for the last time. Everybody. Thanks for listening.
I will shed a tear. You can drop us an email, podcast@wired.co.uk, and follow us on Twitter @wiredUK, and we will all see you next week.
Bye.
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 Except Chris. Liv, can you give me some words?
One for the trouble, oh, two for the time. Fine. Come on, girl, let's rock this joint.
Bad that phrase, everything's fine. And if you just read a madman.
Flesh is back.
Flesh is cool.
Sexy.